All right, so this is round two. Again, we're talking about internal inflation, and we're taking just to practice with little model landscapes. I guess the last one we talked about was this is some scalar field and some potential that looks like this, and then this, and here's a vacuum called is A or B. Yeah, I'm trying to. I probably will get the order wrong. Okay, let's call this A. This is F for false. This is I for intermediate, and this is B. And really, I'm going to further simplify, as people reminded me, and code this into just some diagram, some graph, where F can go into I, and I can go into B, and F can go into A, and there's various rates, and we'll just study that kind of rate equation model. And so Vilenkin calls this the Fabi model. And maybe, depending on time, we might start with the Fab model, which obviously you get by erasing the I. Okay. In particular, as we've been talking about, we will not discuss negative CC minima that will crunch, and this crunch is very interesting. Gary and I have been trying to do this. There's some very interesting questions here, but unfortunately, well, unless Gary is faster than even I can imagine, we will not be able to figure this out by the end of the talk. But there's some interesting questions here. All right, but let's just go through this. Remember, the object was in some global picture. This is some Penrose diagram corresponding to sitting in F. There will be lots of bubbles. Here's an A bubble, and here's a B bubble. Sorry, an I bubble, and it can produce a lot of Bs, and each of these has a little hat on top of it because it's 0 cc FRW, and this is like what the causal diagram of such a thing is. And the question is, we want to count pockets or count bubbles because we regard each of these pockets as an independent try, and they all are equally valid. So rather than trying to count some volume on some slice, which gets people in horrendous trouble because it's sensitively dependent on where you choose, we're going to count bubbles. The first idea we talked about was taking some slice, shooting whirl lines. This is due to ELM. And we counted if a whirl line hits such a bubble, we call it tagged. And the measure we were talking about was the number of tagged A bubbles or the number of tagged B bubbles, was the probability of A over the probability of B. The idea is this was well defined because it focuses on the very finest parts of the fractal, and those don't depend on smooth reparametrizations here. Now we're going to talk about
And you're also saying it's independent of exactly which world line you pick, whether the GD6 or just any timeline curve.
Yeah, I think so. Basically, because all that matters is what you do in some very tiny window here, and any change like that would be just some linear mapping. And I think the fancy way to say it is it's just some Lorentz transformation in the de Sitter space, which can't do anything. So yeah, but it's independent. Again, the idea is anything smooth or even continuous you do here can't change much in the tiniest window, which is blown up to be all the interesting physics up there. Now, there's a slightly different way of saying this.
I'm sorry, I don't remember. These lines, the vertical lines, are these just, I mean, they're not light. What are they?
They're time-like. Okay.
Time-like.
You can think of them as geodesics normal if you want, but you can relax from that if you want. You can give geodesics with a little bit of velocity or something, as long as it's a smooth assignment along there. So there's a related construction due to Vilenkin and his friends. What were those initials? D. Yeah, okay. There's an S in here or something?
Yeah.
Delia Schwartz, yeah. And then there was another, I think there was another one fitting there. Okay. Thank you. Which is to imagine some initial surface and imagine not taking a finite number of whirl lines, but actually using this to construct a set of co-moving coordinates. So, you shoot a bunch of geodesics up, an infinite number. And what you do, you make a cutoff by saying you examine only bubbles that have greater co-moving volume than a certain small amount. Okay? So co-moving, I'll call it length, and we take the volume to the 1/3. is greater than epsilon. So in this infinite cluster of bubbles, and again, it's that infinity that makes life hard, you stop somewhere. You say you take bubbles that when you project them back to the slice, have a size bigger than epsilon. Okay.
Do they worry about the fact that GD6 will typically cross and not be pushed forward and slow them?
I don't think so. Okay. I think... No. Well, they certainly didn't mention it, and I certainly haven't thought about it. Okay. My guess is in these exponentially expanding things, that's pretty unlikely. In bubbles of De Sitter space, that doesn't happen too often. You have this enormous press of repulsion. And so that, my guess is with some analysis, you could show that that was a small effect. Okay, and in this definition, you can actually try to do a numerical calculation with certain rates for these processes of what this measure would be, and I'll go through that. Again, it's useful to consider a special slice where you use this metric ds squared equals dt squared. What's relativity coordinate? This is plus... but why is that funny? This is the most difficult thing for me to remember in the... Okay. The scale factor, dx squared, and this is... And so you'd use... the simple coordinates, that cutoff epsilon is the distance in x. Okay, and here, again, the picture of a nucleating bubble, the light rays are almost vertical, and the amount of co-moving volume you slice out with a bubble rapidly becomes constant. So it's this process, it's a Cantor-like process of when you nucleate a bubble, it slices out a constant piece of co-moving volume, and further, the size of the slice decreases, like the scale factor. The volume goes like the inverse scale factor cubed. And the number of bubbles increases, like the inverse scale factor cubed, because the actual physical volume blows up. So the total amount of co-moving volume you slice out is the same at every time interval. But it gets sliced out in finer pieces. Okay. All right. So that's the essential effect we're going to capture. So the first thing let's do is let's write a rate equation for how co-moving volume gets sliced out. So suppose Fn is the co-moving, I guess the fraction of co-moving volume in bubble type N. And if you want to make fractions well posed, imagine this is a compact space or something. I don't think that's an issue. Then you can write an equation, dfn dt, and I'm going to be a little careless about which times I use. To organize yourself, you know, time might change if you're inside a bubble, but there's just constant shifts you need to make. Dfn dt, yeah?
What does the label n mean?
There are many different types of bubble. Like the n would be A, F, I, or B.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And might have 10 to the 500 values. Okay. But, okay. Nope. I got to use this. I guess this is the letter I use for some reason. M and N have some special meaning, which I'll tell you in a minute. Sum over I of minus kappa ij fj. And I'll tell you plus. So this is just some chemical rate equation for species. Fi. So this first part says the amount of co-moving volume in a certain vacuum J gets decreased if slices of a new kind of bubble get nucleated in it. So there's a minus sign there. And this rate, kappa ij, is the rate for I bubbles to be nucleated in J. There's this funny index ordering which sort of is useful about half the time. Okay. In particular, you don't sum over J here, okay? So this is one of the places where it's not useful. Okay, and here, you're summing over I, and this is the number of times in a J bubble that you make I. Sorry, I got it wrong. It's a number in I bubbles, so this is an I bubble where you make sum of J.
Okay.
Yeah, so you'd call this a particular bubble J0 or something. Okay, that the bump, this index includes the original. So in here, the F would be in this set, the index set. Okay, and K is related to this instanton, the Coleman-DeLucia instanton. It's exponentially sensitive on things, so these numbers can have a wide variety of different values. Okay, so, well, this is, and why is this equation linear? It basically says you're ignoring collisions. Now, if the tunneling rate is very small, you cut out a very small piece of space at every time. And I'll argue there, but it's intuitively clear that when the tunneling rate is small, the dimensionless tunneling rate, epsilon, equal to some instanton rate times h to the fourth, when that's much less than one, collisions are not important.
Every bubble is slightly different, the volume is small, right?
Yes, that's right. So the fraction of bubbles that are involved in a collision of that kind are very small. So this is a funny kind of thing. Everything is fractal and filled with collisions, but in this equation, the effects are very small. And we'll actually do the next step of that. So there would be F squared terms that would involve collisions, but they would have additional rate suppression in them. Now, I mean, some of the subtleties here, which I'm not ignoring, is the tunneling rates also vary vastly. So ignoring an effective order epsilon squared, that might be the leading rate in some other process. So there's a lot of things to worry about, which we haven't done very much of, but it needs to be thought about. Okay, so then you just have a linear equation. You in vector form, you imagine you have some ket that's sum over j, fj, some basis j, and then you write a matrix equation, df dt is equal to a matrix M on F, and the matrix M is given by this stuff. Okay. And so everything of interest in the way that co-moving volume is spliced up is determined by this, the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this matrix. Okay, notice we're not just interested in the total amount of co-moving volume that's sliced up. We're interested in how fine of pieces it's sliced up, because we want to count bubbles. So we'll have to do one more thing. But it's interesting to study this equation. In particular, you might have thought, and I guess I thought, the first thing you should do is just to evaluate, you know, like the fraction of co-moving volume you end up with in every different species. You might say that's a good measure. Okay, you can see here immediately that that won't be independent of how you start. M has a lot of zero eigenvalues. Any of the terminal vacua that don't nucleate anything else, what letter is used for terminals here? No, that, okay. N equal terminal. Think of M and N. Okay, terminal. M and N will be terminal. M on N equals zero for every terminal. Okay, so there's a lot of zero eigenvalues of this matrix. Suppose you imagine F of T as T goes to infinity. You're clearly going to end up in terminals. But which one you end up with is clearly dependent on how much projection onto those zero eigenvectors you started with. Okay, because that's all that happens. The non-zero eigenvectors will relax away. And so depending on how you start, and this is obvious, suppose you started with everything in A, you'd end up with everything in A. You start with everything in B, you end up with everything in B. So that's very dependent on initial conditions. Now you might say, all right, that's fine, but it's a defect. So you might ask, what are the universal properties of such an equation? Well, clearly the things that don't depend on initial conditions are the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this matrix. Okay. And the long-time behavior, which clearly we're interested in building up this fractal, have to do with the slowest, if you will, eigenvalues, the ones that are closest to zero. And so it turns out if you study, and this is Blanken and his friends read the literature on such matrices, if you have matrices that ergodic might be the word, where you can bounce up and down, except in these terminals. There's some word for this matrices, but I'll let you look at the papers. Then they always have a unique leading eigenvalue that's above zero, and of course it's negative. Okay, so let's call that M on S equals, I guess, minus Q S, and Q is the smallest eigenvalue, not equal to zero. This determines what happens to this distribution of volumes as you go to long times. All right. So again, implicit in all this, we think it's interesting to study what happens at long times. Maybe, if Gary has scared me, maybe if you just crunch fast in the world, you don't care about long times. But part of our rules are that we're going to think about long times. So, structure meaning what? It depends very much on these rate constants.
So, can you get the situation where this Q actually goes to zero?
Not if the not if all the rates are non-zero, like a positive matrix. Okay. And so you can have strictly zero eigenvalues, but you have to turn in, you have to basically make a minimum into a new terminal to do that. Okay, so in some sense the answer is yes, you can make a vacuum come down to be terminal. Okay, but if you divide things up into terminal and non-terminal, you're not going to get an accidental zero. And that's actually a tautology, but that's a true statement.
So this is a rate equation for something of all time, and is it sort of independent of time slices in some sense, or less dependent than the volume thing that people were talking about before?
It is independent of the time slicing, and we're just choosing a convenient set of coordinates to evaluate it. Okay.
It's independent.
I mean, it's defined precisely by this taking an arbitrary slice and taking this co-moving cutoff to zero. Okay.
And the rate equation involves some t.
Yes, I know, but we're going to only study the large t limit, and the parts of the thing that depend on the large t limit will be precisely those that are independent of time.
You said you had a number of time intervals tiny volumes. Is there, I mean, I thought the connection between...
No, right, exactly. So we now have to process the volumes into bubble counting. Right, so these quantities are not terribly interesting. Okay, well... They need to be processed to be interesting. So now let's ask for the real thing that we're interested in. I shouldn't have done that. But. Which is how you count numbers of new bubbles nucleated. And so I guess I have to reconstruct a picture like that. So here's a piece of co-moving volume. Let's say that's I. And in I, you can make a bunch of these. How do you figure out at a given time how many B slices you're going to make? So let's write the number of, again, this index ordering, I better do. If J, how many J bubbles, so J, think of J equals B, do you make in a small time interval? Well, in a small time interval, you create a bunch of co-moving volume of B. Is the number of amount of co-moving volume you deposit into V into J from, and I guess I want to say the amount of number of bubbles in an alpha vac in alpha, and alpha is think of alpha as I. So in a particular kind of bubble I, how many B bubbles do you shake off? So in a small interval, you have a certain amount of co-moving volume, but then you have to account for the fact how finely it's sliced. Okay, so you basically multiply by the scale factor. I'll write it as e to the h alpha t cubed. Remember, the bigger, the higher you are in time, the smaller the bubbles. And so this effect counts for the way you slice it up. It's this factor that does bubble counting for you.
And this is the only thing that's invariant?
Well, I think it is invariant. It may not be the only thing that's invariant.
But I mean,
the volumes are certainly not, right. Now, whether there are other invariants is an interesting question. In particular, as you'll see, this kind of measure seems to depend on the eigenvector, not much on the eigenvalue. But the eigenvalue is also something interesting, and I don't know, it must mean something, but I haven't figured out what it means. So I think there's an interesting question there. But okay, so, yeah.
Transit from alpha to J, or alpha?
Yeah. So, yes, I've added some new notation. You think of this kind of term as saying the amount, the number of well, I guess I should think of this term. The amount of J bubbles you make from a particular ith bubble, that's what this term represents.
Right.
Okay, and that I'm abbreviating as FJ alpha. So I'm right now, yeah, I'm gonna now substitute in, which I probably shouldn't have done. So let me now process this and write this as dn j alpha equals, this thing is given by the rate kappa j alpha f alpha dt. In a given small interval of t, this is the rate for nucleating a bubble in the alpha vacuum. And so this tells you how many actual, the count you make. And I'm sorry, I forgot the crucial part, e to the h alpha t cubed. Okay. But now we know something about f alpha at long times. We know here that f of t at long times equals, or f of infinity, plus e to the minus qt times the eigenvector s plus some constant, the projection on that eigenvector. Okay? So in a basis, f alpha of t equals this constant plus c e to the minus qt s alpha. So we can, at long times, we can plug in this expression here. Now the terminals don't contribute any bubbles, so we can delete this part. So we can write this as equal to kappa j alpha constant e to the minus qt s alpha dt. I always forget the most important part. E to the h alpha t cubed s alpha dt.
By long times involves comparing q
to the next higher eigenvalue. That's right. Right. And it will probably be a number of order q. Well, it's not clear, but in a big matrix will be not so different than three times. Okay, so we now know how many bubbles you shake off in a little time. You can now integrate this equation, putting dt under there. The time dependence is just exponential. So you can solve this differential equation. And then you can impose this cutoff. It just involves this scale factor being, I guess, bigger than a certain number 1 over epsilon. So no bigger. Time can't get later than a certain amount, because that would make the bubble shrink to less than epsilon. Okay. So you now analytically can process this co-moving volume cutoff. And you see that the crucial thing that determines how many bubbles you make are these numbers, the coefficients of the eigenvector, and these rates. So to figure out how many bubbles of type J you make, you look in all the bubbles that can possibly feed J, figure out the rate to feed J, and the coefficient of the eigenvector. Okay. So the final result is the probabilities to be in a certain kind of vacuum J is the sum over all feeding bubbles, alpha, the rate to go from alpha into J, times, and this is a proportionality, you'll have to normalize them. Okay. Is it clear what I mean? Okay. All right, so basically the ingredients you need are the eigenvector of this matrix, corresponding to the lowest non-zero eigenvalue, and the rates to go from that eigenvector into various vacuums. So notice it's not somehow something having to do just with the longest-lived vacuum, which might be the longest-lived eigenvalue and eigenvector. It's what that feeds out. This is the analytic image of that statement, that the things that are most probable are the progeny of the longest-lived vacuum. Yes.
You said something very quickly about an epsilon cutoff here.
Yes.
Can you repeat what you're
saying? Okay. So the way to state this cutoff not using whirl lines, that's a cutoff that you can show is equivalent, it's not quite equivalent, is to take on an initial slice, here we pick a horizontal slice, and say you ignore any bubbles smaller than epsilon. The trick here is you go to infinite time, you'll have an infinite number of bubbles. So you have to make that number finite. And the way you make it finite is you ignore any bubbles smaller than epsilon in co-moving volume. Here, in this rate equation, the thing that determines the size of the bubbles is this inverse scale factor. So you integrate this equation up to the point where the inverse scale factor is equal to epsilon, and you stop it there.
So in principle, there's some ratio here relating to epsilon and Q.
Yes, and but the point is that's essentially the same for all different vacuums. It just cancels out.
Okay, so the answer doesn't depend on that.
That's right. The answer doesn't depend on that. But that's right. So what you do, and it's explained in the paper, is you just integrate this equation with a cutoff that makes the scale factor stop. Okay. Yeah, but that dependence is very weak, and it actually cancels out. A slightly more useful way is to go to a time where you go to some t twiddle that's equal to h alpha t, and then that eliminates all the complexity. And then you basically just rescale the rates. All the complexity is buried in these rates. No, you just, it gets built into the different kappas. Okay, you absorb the difference in the H's in different kappas. Remember, these kappas, as I've written them, have dimensions of inverse time. And you can make them dimensionless by multiplying by the various H alphas. Okay, these were the details that I promised you that I would elide. Okay, so this gives you...
Can you say in what way this is different? So now you introduce some dependence on the volume.
No. You mean just by the cutoff?
Yes.
Okay, yes.
So in what way is this an improvement on the previous? Why is this dependence on the volume better than the previous one, where you had to measure the dependence on the finite volume?
You mean the old measures or the measuring F?
The old measure depended on the finite volume,
yeah.
Right? And was problematic.
Right.
Now you're suggesting an improvement.
Yeah.
There is some dependence on the final volume that you...
This doesn't depend... Well, it's a question of late versus early. This doesn't depend on taking some late time slice and evaluating volumes along here. At late times, things are exponentially sensitive. This just depends on using a cutoff at early time. Okay. And here, because of amplification, everything gets focused in small areas where things are universal. Okay, so this...
Before you said you were going to start off with the same bubble.
Not necessarily.
Okay, does that one have to do with being able to start with arbitrary conditions?
No, you can start... you could start in a configuration where you had most of this and some of this or something like that. You know, you can imagine this is your slice. So some of this and a lot of this. I mean...
You end with an equation for the probability to be no more dependent of the initial condition.
I'm sorry?
You have lost the dependence in the initial condition.
That's good. That's a feature, not a bug.
I cannot understand how you do that.
You mean why it should be independent of the initial condition? Well, the picture is that no matter... Suppose you start with an A bubble and no I bubbles. Okay, that is a certain... An A and an F... and no I's. You'll nucleate an I eventually, and the B's that the I sheds rapidly come to dominate the bubble count. So that's the way initial conditions are erased. The long time behavior is independent of the initial conditions because you're doing bubble counting. Okay, and it doesn't and the initial condition will just involve a finite number of bubbles. The bubble counting will involve a very large number of bubbles, and so it's buried in that infinity that the initial conditions get buried. If you were counting the fraction of co-moving volume, and you started with a big A here, that's always going to occupy 20% of your co-moving volume, and you'll never get rid of that. So co-moving volume is not independent of initial conditions.
And is that basically Russo's calculation?
It's close to Bussow's count. I won't talk about it, but I think that that is close to the reason that Bussow's count, of course, is one static patch, and this is global. But it, I think that is essentially the reason that Bussow's system is dependent on initial condition. Now, there is a smoldering debate between various people about whether this is a bug or a feature. You know, maybe it should depend on the initial conditions. Maybe that's not a good thing to have about physics. But so, it's just a fact, okay, that these bubble counting things are independent, can be made are independent, and further, they're independent of all local adjustments, like how you choose the slice, things like that. So they are universal. Now, maybe universality is a bad thing. Okay, I won't get into that. Yeah.
So you're saying you get different answers if you think about it in terms of a single patch as opposed to globally.
I'll come to that. Okay. I think the answer. Well, I want to give an extended answer to that. So let me go on. But I assure you, I will say something about that. Anything else? Okay, so you might say, here's a formula that can be calculated analytically if you have a picture, if somebody gives you a landscape and lets you compute these tunneling rates back and forth. You plug them in, you make a matrix, you diagonalize it, you find the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and then you figure out the probabilities. And in fact, Schwartz and Vilenkin did this on the Bussow-Polchinski landscape. In certain approximations, they had big matrices, they found formulas like this. And they're very interesting answers. Of course, the answers bounce around a lot because these things depend exponentially on where you are. Still, that might be a good thing. It might be interesting. There are things you might want to do better. But so when string theorists stare at this, they're not happy. Okay, despite the manifest attractiveness of the story. most string theorists have profoundly rejected it. And why have they rejected it? Because it's hard for a single observer to diagnose all this stuff. It's a global picture, okay, and a single observer cannot see these bubbles. They're space-like, all these bubbles. They're space-like separated, and there's this profound prejudice that has built up in this field that global things are not to be, global questions are not to be asked. Okay, they're not even to be
complicated.
No, I think it's actually stronger than that. I think it is like they should not even be asked. It's like he who should not be named. I mean, well, all right, we can debate the sociology. Okay. Well, but I think it is now turned into a prejudice rather than a principled point of view. Nonetheless, I think it is a very healthy point of view because we know we've gotten in trouble asking these questions. The classic example on black holes, if you look at global things both inside and outside the horizon and you're not careful, you can decide that information should be lost. Some of our colleagues have persisted in this error for 20, 30 years.
You're not quite sure because you can view cosmic variance.
I'm sorry?
Cosmic variance.
Yeah.
You can view as the measure of the lack of information about what goes on in patches that are larger than our cosmic variance. This is the view that Andre and then Korfman have been introducing.
Yeah.
So there are some questions that
have a dense black hole. Yeah. For instance, Hawking radiation can be derived from a global point of view. It was a brilliant discovery. It's just not quite right. It's not exactly thermal. Okay. So I actually am with you in this. I think, there are many, in fact, I've spent a lot of my career in the last few years trying to look behind horizons and stuff. I reject the fact that those questions are not to be asked. The prejudice is, though, is they're hard to answer. The mysterious words about black hole complementarity and things like that get mumbled. And okay. So we don't know a lot about what we're doing if we start trying to evaluate a global measure, in particular if we want to really evaluate probabilities and not just evaluate something qualitative. So I would say that this causes many people, and probably including me for a while, to reject these things. a number of people, of course, have pointed out this weakness, and people have tried to construct pictures of this eternal inflation within a causal patch. Busseau, in particular, has done very important work trying to formulate this, and he's made what I consider really important observations about why this is a good thing to do. Recently, my colleagues Moni Susskind and Sacchino and Ben Freevogel have constructed what they think is a conformal field theory description of the physics in one of these static patches. Okay, and that's a very interesting point of view, and actually will be somewhat related. I won't be talking about that. In particular, I will not talk about some potential holographic description of it with a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian and all this stuff. What I will do is I will try to address this question by asking, what can a single observer observe that might be related to these issues? Okay, and my claim will be, in the simplest, most attractive such situations, and this is answering your question, you see essentially the same probabilities that are derived by these people in a global point of view. And so these are not numbers to be sneered at and ignored. Okay, that a single observer in favorable circumstances and other circumstances they cannot will get the same answers. Okay.
For a single observer, what do these probabilities mean?
Well, I'll give you a very concrete... and because it's a real observer and a real experiment, I mean, there is a very vivid answer to that question, which I'll say in a minute. Yeah. Yeah, basically that. Yeah, or more picturesquely, I mean, most bubbles will eventually saturate at constant co-moving volume. It's roughly that constant co-moving volume. That's what I mean by the size. I don't mean the very initial tiny thing there that's dependent on the details of the dynamics. That's right. The initial conditions have to be, let's say C1, let's say differentiable or something. Are you worried about bubbles down here?
Well, I'm just saying that they form if you're arguing on a certain size anyway, right? Yeah, wherever you're...
Well, the odds of a bubble nucleating within 2 seconds of this time interval is exponentially small, and I'll ignore anything that's exponentially small, like the border epsilon, like that. I'm not sure what the worry is that you're
talking about. Smaller later.
Yes. That's right.
Time cutoff.
And so the picture, that's right. This translates into a time cutoff in this simple set of coordinates. In more complicated coordinates, it might be more complicated.
That's a future time cutoff.
That's right.
It's I'm sorry. I thought you kept saying the thing you imposed on the initial slice.
It is. It's both.
I thought I see why it's not.
Okay. So it's a slice. A way of saying it is you project back the bubbles, and you say a bubble here, how in co-moving coordinates, how big is its image on this initial line? Okay, it's a little sphere or something. Okay, if the sphere is smaller than epsilon, you ignore it. Okay?
It wasn't even there, but that's not the point.
Well, it was there if you went very, very late. It'll be tiny, tiny things form, arbitrarily tiny.
It wasn't there on that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. You take a late time bubble and you project it back and you look at its pre-image, even though it wasn't there. Right. And that you'd use that to decide when you keep and when you discard. Yes?
What you just said seems to be in conflict with this idea of uniformity, that probability distribution is uniform. It seems to be in conflict with the usual idea that late time is based on globally. Space
time
is very
inhomogeneous. Yeah.
Right. So you were saying.
No, I've already explained that actually.
Why?
Because that uniformity happens on very, very small scales. Okay. And so the fact that this initial condition is smooth, what I'm talking about in here is projecting that roughness back down to here. It's not actually rough down here. So you use this to establish a coarse graining length for late time. The advantage is it doesn't involve a late time slice where things are exponentially sensitive. Okay. Right, so now we come to the Well, it's 45 minutes. We could do now these examples. We could put in explicit rate coefficients. I guess this is K from F to A. This is K from F to I. This is kappa from I to B. We put in these numbers, and we could run this. It's a 4x4 matrix, and I could do it for you. It's done in the paper. Okay. But I think I won't because of the time constraints. But in particular, what you find in a model where this rate, bi, is smaller than everything else, that means that this vacuum I is very long-lived. Now, in eternal inflation, every vacuum is long-lived in some sense. What I mean by long-lived is the pieces that tunnel out of it are very finely chopped. Okay? And so what happens rapidly is a picture like this. Well, you fall into A's. Suppose the probability for making A and I is the same. These are the same. Okay, from F. So you have a 1A bubble, you have an I bubble. But then this one gets chopped into very, very fine hash, B hash. Okay. And A doesn't get chopped up into anything because it's terminal. So if you're bubble counting, B's dominate over A's. And in fact, in the limit of time going to infinity, B's are infinitely more likely. And so what happens is the eigenvector has a zero component to make A, and it's only got a non-zero component to make B. So the ratio of the probabilities is 1 to 0. There's an infinity there. And it's basically that at a certain value of these numbers, the eigenvalues cross, and the lowest eigenvalue becomes one with a strictly zero element in it.
I can't go back to F.
No, so you could do that, okay? And then things would not be precisely zero. Or as people asked yesterday, you could have a rate like this that makes things not exactly zero. Okay, so in a decorated, more complex matrix, these zeros aren't there, but things depend exponentially on small numbers. Okay, so... All right, but now I want to finally come to, if you will, the beginning of my talk after the review. Which is, what happens if you insist on questions that a single observer can answer? Okay. So, and this is things that Alex Maloney and Lenny and I have been talking about. So you remember that one way of formulating this measure, which you can prove is equivalent to this covariant cutoff, is to take N whirl lines. And basically, the number of whirl lines indicates the rough spacing between them, which corresponds to this epsilon. So that's why the cutoffs are essentially the same. And you let the whirl lines go forward, and you talk about tag bubbles. And clearly here, you tag more B bubbles than you tag A bubbles. And so B dominates. And here, you consider all whirl lines that go up to any future time like infinity. What a single observer can see in a final, let's say, FRW thing, this is future time like infinity. A single observer can see stuff that comes up to there. So our profound modification of this measure is just to say, shoot up all these whirl lines and just study the ones that go up to a single future time like infinity. So you kind of divide this thing into a bunch of separate hats. And then you compute the probability by just focusing on these whirl lines and the bubbles that they tag. Okay? And so remember, one way of formulating the measure here was to take the tagging to involve all these whirl lines, and the probability of X over Y was the number of tagged X's over the number of tagged Y's. Here, this is what the measure that we call for obscure reasons 2. Here, we will define a new measure called 2 hat. Okay. This is probably the best thing in this project so far, I would say. You restrict yourself to whirl lines that end in 1 hat. I'm not sure I understood the point. Okay. Well, all right. It's better I don't ask.
One terminal vacuum.
That's right. This is a terminal vacuum, and we will ask about the dependence on which terminal it is. That is the question you're asking. So in particular, let's pick A or something, and we will have to ask the... And 2-hat is, in that terminal, take all the whorl lines and end of that terminal, so you say it's the number of tagged X's. Tag means by single hat whorl lines over the number of tagged Y's. This is PX X over P hat.
So you don't let X or Y be A, because everything goes to A.
Well,
A is just appearing one series.
Yes, that's the point. It's negligible. All right. So the question is, why am I doing this? This seems to eliminate all the interesting complexity here. Okay. But the point is, it doesn't. That's the point. The point is, as I mentioned previously, a crucial aspect, and in order to be unpleasant, this is the part that I feel Busso has ignored in his construction, is that bubbles collide. Even though in this rate equation we were correct to ignore them, if we demand that we are looking at a single hat, an infinite number of bubbles will collide with it. So the correct structure to think about is this, and then to think about, let me think about the initial bubble. Then a large number of bubbles collide with it. Now, this picture is slightly misleading. Imagine that this thing has this extra dimension of a sphere. Bubbles collide at different places on the sphere. So it looks like this kind of, gecko with little, what are they called? Things that make a lizard skin. Scales, like hanging on to the thing, okay? And now we have to ask, what can the observer see? If these different minima are the nicest type for our purposes, and here this is an important assumption that I will, relax as we talk. Suppose A and B are part of effectively a moduli space. So you have all these metastable minima, but by the time you end in a terminal, you're essentially on some supersymmetric minima that's on a moduli space. Now, I'm aware that if n equals 1 supersymmetry, you're never really on a moduli space because you run out to infinity, but that's, for my purposes, almost a moduli space. Then, it turns out if you take two bubbles, let's say here's the moduli space, and here's A, and here's B, and so as soon as the bubbles collide, here's A and B, then there's sort of like a, it starts in time. Here's a piece of A, and think of this as a value of a scalar field. And I think Memley Durant draw it a little bit more compellingly. There's A and there's B. But remember, you're on a moduli space. Did I erase the moduli space? What did I do?
I did erase
the moduli space. This is the moduli space, and this is the slices of the causal thing. So here's A, and here's B, and then there's gradients. They cause this to relax to the same value, and here's an average value, C. Okay. So basically, remember the gradients in the field equations that cause these A and B to sort of merge into each other. So a time slice, this might be...
A and B are on the same moduli?
Yes, on the same moduli space. Okay, that's what's simplest. And then there'll be a physics question about how likely that is. Okay, so then maybe the next picture will be some kind of peanut with A, B, and then let's call this middle point sort of C. And then as you go further in time, it'll become sort of almost circular. The things will relax to almost a uniform value of the moduli space in a simple FRW geometry. You'll have a little bit of A all the way over here and B, and most of this will be almost C. Yes, that's right. Hubble friction in the absence of any potential term to oppose it. Okay. And so the claim is that at long times, this picture of two different bubbles merge into one future FRW. That means that a single observer, sort of standing here, can see it all. And so the way you draw this on causal diagrams is the future time-like infinity extends all the way out here. So this observer can see what hit the thing. I'm not sure what that word means.
and you're saying you can see far.
Well,
what's going to happen?
No. I mean, there's causality here. You see what happened in the past. But the claim is there's not a region. It's not like this observer cannot see this stuff. It's in the backward light cone of the single observer. Yeah.
The only thing is that the observer has to live exponentially long.
Okay. Yes, that is correct. But in the world of Gedanken experiments, it is Gedanken. Okay. It can be contemplated.
Is this one that involves? This one that involves decompactification, would you just as happy with it?
Decompactification of what? Oh, you mean of the moduli space limit?
Yeah, 10 dimensions.
Although that makes life substantially more confusing, but I think the answer is...
That's
a point on the moduli space.
Well, there's always going to...
But let's imagine that you have, like, you're in some type 2 situation with a Calabi-Yau moduli space. The fact that the dilaton rolls to 0 means it's, I guess, in some sense, supercompactification. Right, the 11th dimensional circle goes to 0 size. No, but if these two start at finite radius, probably the average is also going to be at finite radius. Okay, I mean the potential that pushes you out to infinite size is much weaker. It's exponentially small in the dilaton than the averaging force. Here's a nice finite averaging force. You start with a region of 2 string lengths and 1 string and a half a string length. They're going to want to average to 1 string length compared to the very weak potential that forces you out.
But ultimately,
that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Terminal vacuum. Well, it comes into large class of terminal vacuum, or these 10-dimensional things.
Yeah. Yeah. I would like to hope that that's not important. Yes.
So, here, you know what happens to the situation in this type of situation? You are likely to get.
They relax because of Hubble friction. It's flat space FRW. You have damping.
So there's no.
There's no inflationary chaos or anything like that. Yeah.
So it's enough here for an observer in your final terminal bubble to see a piece of all these bubbles.
That's right.
It's not going to see everything.
That's right.
But as long as it sees a little bit.
In fact, except for this irritating decompactification stuff, I mean, if you allow me to construct some model, I think as you go to infinity, you see more and more.
I don't think so.
Even though the moduli are flattening out.
You don't ever see the whole thing, though.
No, but I mean, there's a limiting process. If you have a point you want to see, you can go far enough out that you see it. Okay. Let me, all right, I'm now going to appeal to authority, okay? One way of thinking about this is to take a uniform situation and imagine small perturbations in a modulus. It's clear that those relax. So at the end point in the process, you might view it accurately depending on that. The other thing is that Frivogel and Busso studied a module like this where they imagined a piece of dust between two same vacuum, and they analytically produced a metric that does what I said it does. Okay, so I will combine those two into into authority. Yeah.
At risk of being irritating,
you have very strong competition, let me assure you. you're not even...
The generic thing is
You mean because of which bubbles you choose?
There's a huge amount of volume out there. Generically, everything, all of the probability might run off in that direction.
Yeah, I guess there it depends on some details about how you make this landscape and how you fight, as you know very well, various things against each other.
I'm not so sure, because I think there's always a limit like that.
But why are you worried about all the ADS vacuums,
which decays are much faster?
Well, okay, yeah.
Those are much faster.
Steve, I have a diplomatic answer. I believe that's a very interesting question. that is part of what needs to be done in analyzing the phenomenology of the subject. Okay, so I think the idea would be then to go beyond these model situations and then try to put this thing against a more realistic set of landscape ideas. I think that is maybe the most pressing question in this little subject. So I. Well, rather than irritating, I think you're prescient. Okay. Yes. You be quiet.
Just means up to you keeping your bubble contained.
I'm sorry?
If you allow bubble to collide,
yeah,
you're filling your bubble contained.
No. Yeah. Right. Technically, yes, but we can soup it up, so no. Okay. Yes. Yes, I'll tell that. Well, I'm not sure what you mean, but something close, yeah.
About the decompaction thing,
yeah.
The argument here being that that rate is really slow, but you just convinced us that the ones that live the longest, their progeny, are the most common.
Right.
Wouldn't that make decompaction the progeny of the longest lived vacuum? And then,
yeah, well. Yeah, that is possible, and that becomes a very interesting question. Then the limit then that you fight against is some anthropic bound on the size of extra dimensions, okay? Because we know empirically that the extra dimensions are not what they're smaller than a micron or something. So the question is, why aren't the extra dimensions 10 feet tall? Okay, so I believe that was part of the homework assignment that I gave you if you explored it far enough. Yeah.
Can you soup this up to compare different terminals? Assuming you have two terminals, R and radius and M theory and something else.
There's a good question there, and I'll there are two ways to think about that. Okay, so I'll actually come back to that question in a minute. Okay, so in this, if you ignore the technical objections and ignore the conceptual objections, okay, in this situation. And so the idea then is you have what Guthin Weinberg, who thought about this all hard, called a collision cluster or something. I think that's, all the bubbles that collide with one. So the idea is you now shoot a bunch of whirl lines. Now it's true. And it's true that all these things are technically one bubble. You do bubble counting by saying just pass a domain wall and go 10 seconds, and if you're still in a homogeneous thing, you count it as a bubble. Okay, so you sort of have quasi-bubbles. Okay, and you count, so this is like a B, and this is A, and this is an A individual. You count the numbers of A's and B's, and that's the measure. And instead of this original one, you count the numbers of A's and B's in a given collision cluster. Okay, now this, roughly speaking, is vividly observable. This is Herman's question. You lie back on your back, and you wait a long time. That's an observer going up like this. And sort of after a while, he can see roughly his backward light cone is like that. Let me draw it right here. All he sees is the original A. He waits long enough, and he starts seeing B. This looks like a spot that lights up on his sky. And to make it even more vivid, imagine these A's and B's have different values of the standard model parameters. So the Lyman alpha radiation is shifted by a little bit. You look in your sky, looking at Lyman alpha, and you see spots with different frequencies of Lyman alpha. Okay, and then you have a counter, and you count the number of spots of A and B, independent of their size. That's bubble counting. And so that is, it's really observable, and is observable the way that particle counting in a detector is. And then you gradually see them melt into as the moduli space is, but you have a clear signal. So that is, and that measure, the next claim is, that measure is the same as the Vilenkin et al. Measure in nice circumstances.
And what you're seeing in your factor, are you in C?
Well, you're in one of the terminals. And the reason it doesn't depend on which one is because you're counting bubbles. That's just one count. You have zillions, in fact, essentially infinite things, scales on top of this A. And so the A is just one count. When you count zillions, that one count is a small, effect. Okay? Now, in more interesting situations, what I just said is not true. Okay? But the argument, which, fortunately, I don't have time to go through, is that in nice circumstances, which, for instance, that everything is on a moduli space, two, That's the Voinkin et al. ELM measure. And we are about 95% sure that that's the case. Okay.
Can you find nice?
Nice, well, this is an example of nice. Okay, and I'll give you an example of not nice in just a minute. Okay. And the reason, basically, is if you start with a given... I'm really tired of drawing these paths, but... Okay. I guess I want to erase that. If you imagine looking here, and that could potentially... its Lycones could potentially collide with this initial A, are the probabilities for this nucleation place influenced by whether this is A or B? No, they're not. This is an independent piece of space, and it can fall into A or B independently. So that's roughly the reason that the measures are the same. More technically, in co-moving coordinates, if this is the bubble of A, the things that can collide with that are in this light cone. That looks like, and I guess I've been calling that the collision funnel. Now, the collision funnel in physical volume is a surface of one Hubble distance this way and a sphere the other way. And so basically what you do is you redo the Voinkin et al. Rate equations in that sphere. And they're essentially independent, and they come give you the same answer up to numbers of order 1 that I haven't succeeded in computing. But you know a priori that if you take the average of all different hats, you have to end up with 2. So therefore, if you argue that the fluctuations between different hats are small, which comes, I think, from Poisson statistics, and n is large, then the 2 has to be equal to 2 hat because the fluctuations are small. So therefore, the numerical factors are the same. Okay, so I think those are the arguments. But this is the nicest situation. Let's give an example of a situation where this is not true. A situation where this is not true is suppose you have what's a good word for moduli space? M? I guess, okay. So suppose you have 2 separate moduli spaces. There's M and N. And suppose that you can have a bunch of different terminals in M and a bunch of terminals in N. And suppose M and N really don't like each other. And so here's a typical, so I'll call this A and B, or 2 representatives. Suppose this is A, and suppose the potential between them is like that. It's very flat and wide. Then when they come together, instead of smoothing out, they make a domain wall. And worse, the domain wall is very wide and flat. This domain wall inflates. So then, instead of these bubbles merging, they do something like this. Okay, the global picture is gone now. Here's an A hat starting out. Here's a B. They got to collide. Okay. So instead of colliding, they come close and they make this domain wall that inflates. The region here inflates, and you end up with a situation like this. That's a piece of inflating bubble. No, this is not in the terminal. There's a causal patch up here for A and a causal patch up here for B, which I've drawn miserably. So the causal patches are separate. So an observer in A can never count B's. They are behind the horizon. They don't show up as spots on his sky.
That's like a wall patch, right? You should have a hat. WAB should label what's happening in the future of the wall because there's some physics going on there.
Yeah, yeah. But the point is, if you pick a single future infinity, it's either M type or N type. And these are kind of like super selection sectors. If I observe, it's like Schrodinger's cat because these things have enormous degrees of freedom. If I measure here that I'm in type A, all the other things I'll see will come from the M moduli space. If I happen to measure B, I'll find just things on the sky in the N moduli space. There's a question about how you would describe that in terms of a full quantum holographic description of this. What it would have to be, I'm afraid, is it would have to be different components of a wave function. This gives life to this Zen koan that Lenny muttered about in Strings 2005. That these inflationary statistics get coded into quantum mechanical bubble, quantum mechanical, these many worlds get coded into a quantum mechanical many worlds in a single patch.
The statement that there are two different moduli spaces is really a low energy statement. It's really an effective statement.
Yeah.
And your statement that there's a potential between vacuum that belong to different ones tells us that in some kind of off-shell formulation,
yeah,
there's one moduli space with two kind of valleys.
Well, I don't call that a moduli space.
Well, no, because
configuration space.
Configuration space, okay. But I mean, you're so for some reason you're not labeling the kind of flat region the way you labeled your Fabi guys over there.
It's very different, though. Okay.
It's different, but see, can you distinguish? If you're looking at, say, A, you don't see B, but you see some effect of this topological inflation.
That's right.
So you can tell not that you're not going to be in life, but something.
Yes, you certainly can do that.
Oh, okay.
But you cannot directly determine the statistics of the many different types of B bubble that hit here. You know something has happened. Just the same way if you had a single A, you know something was before this. You know that F was here. Yes.
Uh-huh. Doesn't succeed in getting a non-gravitational dual, but instead every way there's something to do it.
Uh-huh.
You still have gravity in the dual.
Uh-huh.
So there's a kind of limitation on how much of a ordinary combinatorial probability interpretation you have. Does that, do you see any of that kind of limitation popping up here? I mean, you seem to be trying something that's pretty very precise.
I think those issues would probably show up in the quote-unquote nice situation as well. So I don't see that as being the clue to the nice and the very not nice. Offhand, I don't. I think there is. I think you're right. And I'll mention another fundamental limitation in a minute that might be relevant as well. Now, an intermediate situation between these is that you have... Yeah.
The option here is that you can look back towards your own white line thing by.
That's right.
Probability.
That's right.
But you don't see anything that's separated by any barrier.
Well, no. By here we are talking about a very bad kind of barrier, a barrier that produces an inflating domain wall. I'll now talk about exactly the situation. Suppose you have this situation and you have a semi-not nice, let's do just a not nice situation, where the barrier, there's a domain wall of finite size, but this thing is sharp enough that you don't inflate. So now you have to ask what happens when you have two bubbles that hit and they make a domain wall, but there isn't this enormous, very flat situation here that causes real inflation, bulk inflation. And so the geometry that you're interested in studying is a relative of what is called a VIS metric. This is three people, Vilenkin, Ipser, Sikivi. Okay, and this one of the world's experts on this is Doug Early. So if you have any questions, don't ask me, ask him. Okay, so then roughly speaking what happens is you have an A bubble, a representative of this moduli space, and a B bubble colliding, and they make a domain wall, which is a time-like object, so it just goes forward. And then, roughly speaking, what does the causal picture look like? It's this. So you have two time-like infinities. These things don't, a single observer cannot see everything involving the B bubble, but he can see something. Without going behind a horizon, you can see that you're in a B bubble. So you can do some counting of Bs, but I'm not sure if you can do everything like you can in the nice case. This is the case that's probably most relevant for, you know, most of the physics that we'll contemplate. Yes?
Is that no matter how low tension that domain wall is? I would have thought that...
I think the answer is yes, yeah. As long as it doesn't melt away. Yeah.
So what's the key? You're doing this fix in some local fixing match.
Right.
Now,
you have some argument saying that from the statistics in one local patch, you can deduce about statistics of other local patches that you have no access.
I know, I wouldn't even bother to ask that question. I mean, are you talking about the very nice situation, or you know, can we talk about the very nice?
Whatever.
Okay, then I wouldn't bother. I would say, physics is determined by what an observer can see. This is what an observer, it turns out the formula describing the probabilities for different terminals and different, all, everything different, not just terminals, is given by a formula that amazingly looks like that Vilenkin et al. Formula. But it comes from observing, from counting on the sky. Okay, so I don't have to ask this question. It's a question a single observer can study.
So you're supplementing this local dash with some other way of defining the...
I'm studying the full local patch after collisions, I would say. The simplest idea of a local patch is just a hat, a wedge. But the real local patch is much richer, and that richness contains all kinds of bubbles hitting it, and the counting of this gives you an interesting measure that has all the nice properties of the whatever the D, G, V, W measure. The slogan, which, and I like slogans, is that you don't have to ever think, well, that's not quite right. In the nice situation, you don't have to think about a true multiverse, which string theorists are allergic to. A single observer can see an effective multiverse of bubbles that don't come into causal contact until late, so that a single observer can count them. But many of the weirdnesses of a multiverse, like there being many separate baby universes that make many tries at different values of parameters and so on, are contained in this effective multiverse. And things like measures and so on of this kind can be, in the nice situation at least, a property of single observer descriptions. Yes?
So it seems likely that we're in one of the
the, like the bad but not very bad.
Maybe very bad, but certainly bad. So is your lesson that we should adopt two hat and forget about two as being metaphysical, or we should try to figure out how two hat can be supplemented by two because the probabilities of getting in different disconnected patches from a two hat point of view, or what's the...
Yeah, I think I don't have a good answer to this. My hunch right now is that what you should do is that, let's say in a very bad situation, where these bubbles of A's and B's, you have A-type clusters and B-type clusters. These are like, this is like the cat alive and the cat dead. We do a measurement and figure out, oh, the cat is alive. Then we should never think about cat dead vacua. Okay.
We're not in A or B, we're in it earlier.
That's right. So, but I think probably, you know, this super selection sector, you know, is correlated. You see what it obviously will fall into. I guess you're right. I guess you're right. So then, I guess in that case, I guess you would have to think about the quantum mechanical probabilities. You're right, actually. That was too strong a statement. But it would have to do with sort of with the entropies we're in. It's an enormously, you know, uncorrelated process. But I guess you're right. In the semi-nice or the semi-bad case, there you actually can see stuff, and there's an interesting counting problem of what you can see into. Okay, and there I think there's at least some statistic that might not be quite the same as two, the two-hat bad, if you will, semi-bad, that it is well defined because there are time-like whirl lines that can reach from here to here that you can count. And so there is a well-posed measure, and it's an interesting question that we haven't gotten straight. What is that measure? It's going to have the same qualitative features that the progeny of long-lived vacua are dominate. Okay, so at least in the hunt, we can already say that's what you should hunt for. Whether the measure is numerically the same is not. Okay, so that is the sort of conceptual part. And now in the last few minutes, I guess we can start talking about... No, I have more conceptual stuff. I'm sorry. So you might say, and the reason for these assumptions are that if you can say what a single observer sees in this hat, that there might, in that happy future, you know, soon to come, I'm sure, when we understand everything about string theory, that there'll be some holographic description of what A sees, and it maybe it's Lenny's conformal field theory, maybe it's something else. But there's a fundamental problem, okay, which is that there are these unlikely events. I'm now looking from the top. This is a single bubble being nucleated, and its future time-like infinity is here. But there are these unlikely events where you can have simultaneously nucleation, I mentioned this at the end of last time, that make a ring. This future time-like infinity is a sphere in the full four dimensions. This future time-like infinity, I believe, this is an inflating thing in the center. Here's another thing, Gary, where I could use you and your fellow experts' help. I think it has to be a torus. There's no way to get rid of this inflating region in the center. So there are different topological types of future time-like infinity. And so you have to ask, what do you do with them? I mean, the most upsetting possibility, you know, Lenny and his friends have a conformal field theory. In the simplest thing, this conformal field theory is evaluated on a sphere. Should you evaluate it on the torus? Should you add up the diagrams as a string perturbation series? The string coupling is the probability of nucleating these different topologies. Is that string perturbation series divergent? What are the D-brains? I mean, it's enough to make you sick. Or should you just restrict yourself for some reason to this particular simple time future time-like infinity? That seems a little arbitrary. But so there's this, what seems to me to be a rather deep conceptual question about, like, what would you even hope to make a fundamental description of before you even try to make it? And that, I think it was worth thinking about. Okay, now I finished the conceptual part. Now, I think in the final 2 hours, we should talk about the...
Can you say a little more about the experimental part?
Yes. Yes, I can.
You're talking about the Lyman alpha light.
Yeah. No, this is...
different points of the sky.
Yeah, you'll see a blotchy sky. Now, if there's a period of slow roll inflation, which there probably is, unfortunately, in our universe, you're going to have to wait a very long time to see that. But, you know... this is a Gedanken experiment. So
I think you're calculating probabilities that are not just terminal.
Yeah, that's right. You will see other everything. Everything.
We don't live in the terminal.
I'm aware of that. Yeah. I wish we were in some ways, but we don't.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Whereas this sort of picture, the single observer picture, yeah, I'm sympathetic to it, but
yeah.
With black hole, still one gets a lot of information from
contemplating
the what's behind. So what's the analog?
I think the analog is that these rate equation formulas that Vilenkin, let me not bias it, that DGVW studied, are much simpler than restricting the rate equations to a collision funnel. It's much simpler to just compute the global collision probabilities. That I guess I view as the analog. Yeah. Okay. So then, now the question is, in a reasonable that word maybe in a possibly reasonable landscape, how are these measures going to come out? One question is, are we in the nice situation? Probably not. Are we in the really bad situation, or are we in the semi-bad situation? I mean, when you fall down, in some sense, you might imagine falling down in some type 2 moduli space, but suppose you could fall down in a heterotic or type 2 or 11 dimensions. I mean, there obviously are things that are not going to be smoothly connected, except infinite. And I think infinite distance here would imagine the closest way to get is probably to come up to Planck scale and then run back down. That's what the shortest path would be. And then there's this question about whether you inflate because you're Planckian scales and this whole unknown morass. But there's still, if you just take this basic lesson that what you're looking for are the progeny of long-lived vacua, what are the longest-lived vacuas in a semi-realistic landscape? Now here we come back to this question that I told you at the beginning I was going to avoid, and now it's time. That the thing that governs the lifetime, probably, of most of the vacua we know about, including the one we live in, is not so much the height. Suppose this is a positive cc, and here's a zero cc. This is where we live. This tiny height probably has nothing to do with the decay time. The decay time is probably governed by this negative cc ADS thing that's nearby. Certainly, any simple estimate says that This happens much faster than, let's say, this. In fact, roughly speaking, if you think about, D-brain instantons in a Busso-Polchinski setup, this thing is enormously suppressed. This thing, the rates here are dominated by the largest CC. So here the largest CC is pretty small. Here the largest CC is this one, which can be string scale. Okay, so, yeah.
I'm not sure. Again, if you have decompactification, in some sense there's a lot more phase space out there.
You mean, and that can stabilize things? Yeah, Eva was telling me this, and which is quite right. If you imagine in Busso-Polchinski that the circles are very large, then the instanton amplitudes are very small. So that effectively stabilizes things. So that is one stabilization mechanism.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if it's quite the same, but it's just, in a sense, I think a lot more volume out of it. In the sense of
volume about points?
Well, sort of places you can go to. So it's final state.
Which makes the rates higher?
You might guess that, and I don't know a good calculation.
Okay, that would be interesting. You're fighting against exponential dependencies as you make radii bigger and sort of power law volume. So I would tend to think that you would lose. There's another way you stabilize these things. So Eva, in fact, has been emphasizing to me that large volumes are a nice way to stabilize things. But another way is supersymmetry. If you ignore supersymmetry, this rate is pretty fast. But if this vacuum is almost supersymmetric, let's say our world supersymmetry is TeV, okay, then the tunneling rate here is not governed by this large negative CC. It's governed by the supersymmetry breaking scale. So it's the tunneling rate might be e to the minus 1 over, what's it called, w naught squared. And then there's something up here, which is kind of the tension of the domain wall. And depending, if this is very tiny, like, let's say, TeV, and this is, well, this could string scale for some reason, then this is an enormous suppression. Okay? So now, again, these long-lived vacua, suppose they feed vacua with equivalently small CCs or large radii. I'm not sure exactly why that's true. Then you might guess that this measure will exponentially favor low CC vacua, sorry, low supersymmetry breaking scale vacua or large radii vacua, or both. And the problem is there's no reason that the supersymmetry breaking scale should stop at a TeV, assuming that the landscape is rich enough to have supersymmetry breaking scales of all different sizes. Why isn't the supersymmetry breaking scale a microelectron volt or the value of the current supersymmetry of the current cosmological constant? These measures will be exponentially dependent. Okay, and then I remind you that if you use anthropic arguments with an exponentially peaked measure peaked at the zero supersymmetry breaking scale, which is zero CC, the mystery is why is the CC we observe so large? Okay, because if you have an exponential measure, life can live at any CC smaller than the anthropic bound. The only reason you think it's at the edge is because the measure is rather smooth. If you have exponentially peaked measures, you there's a problem.
You would predict they're exactly 10 to the 60 vacua or something, and we have the smallest CC.
No. That is a possibility, though. Okay. That's right. So you need two things. You take a long-lived vacuum like I, yeah. But the I count is negligible. It's the progeny of the long-lived vacuum. Well, the question is, does an almost supersymmetric vacuum have even more supersymmetric progeny? Or are they, I don't actually, this is one of the questions one needs to think about. I can build models that do that. You know, what are they called? ISS, is that what they're called? Two ISS models with vastly different scales. The first cascade tunnels one ISS thing down to zero. You still have the second thing left. Okay, you can arrange the scale so that this sets up. Now, this is obviously not an attractive model. Okay, but they do exist.
The idea is that might even be better from what we just see because we've been close to the things, large volume or whatever.
That's right. That's right. And the large volume anthropic bound seems even more miserable, doesn't it? I mean that they're, well, I need, I see
more. But again, so the original Busso-Polchinski argument is completely swamped by this. If you superimpose this particular structure on
that's right.
It's gone.
Yeah, now, that's right. The counting measure is pretty flat. And so the sorry.
I guess the difference between a model where you don't
Yeah. That's well, and you use, let's say you use D-brain instantons to compute rates. That's right. That's right. You fix radii and then use D-brain instantons of that radius, but you don't study the stabilization problem.
How do you deal with the anti-universe problem? Because that was what always came up somehow.
Well, you'll have to put a second anthropic. Right. Right, but suppose you have a CC of one GeV. Is there any reason why you can't have a slow roll inflation that populates you above baryogenesis? I mean, you have to put the slow roll thing as another anthropic cut. But if that's the dominant anthropic cut, it might mean that things are quite different, you know. So the question is, what's the dominant anthropic cut? I can't believe I'm talking like this. Yes, I'm being recorded, but I plan to erase it as soon as. Let me say one more thing a minute. I mean, a crucial thing that we have not studied, though, is that if you fall into non-supersymmetric, if you fall into these things, by saying they're stabilized by supersymmetry, I have made some naive assumptions. One of the questions about these crunches that occur, and these questions Gary and I have been talking about, is that really a good intuition? If whenever you fall into these things, you destroy everything around you, then the measure will be quite different. You won't live that long, and you should be counting. The most important thing will be to find minima that don't tunnel very fast into negative CC things for some reason, because those will be the things that live. If everything that falls into here is killed, then you have quite a different counting problem, and so that becomes a really important issue to decide. And I hope that's one of the things we can decide during this workshop. I think it falls under the heading of string phenomenology, but maybe not obviously. Yes.
I lost it.
Yeah.
Am I supposed to think of this AVS state as one of its version of a terminal state?
That is unspecified. It's certainly not a terminal state because you'll crunch when you come into it.
Yes, but there was a transition here.
I warned you that I was going to ignore any such vacua. All my analysis was up to this point. And then 2 minutes ago, right. And so all of a sudden now you have to understand what these things do, okay, in that. Now suppose these things are mild and don't make a big effect. Okay, then the analysis will go as before and you'll just have little black parts on the sky corresponding to these crunches or something. Or better yet, they're like black holes and they'll just evaporate quickly and you won't notice them. If they destroy the world, and then you have something else to do.
This
one, which is almost supersymmetric? Yeah.
Yes. Is that almost? Can I think of that as almost a terminal in your picture, or is that?
For many ways, yes. Now again, this measure doesn't only count terminals.
Right.
Okay. So the measure in this one will be could be very, if it spits off. If there was a deeply, an almost stable, I guess, thing here that fed only into this, this would count as the progeny of a long-lived vacuum. Okay, so in some sense, if it weren't for this little problem, I would say hunt for these. Isolated things with big walls that happen to feed into a universe like ours. That would be interesting. Okay, but I think the first thing to do is to figure out if these things just swamp this whole picture. All right. The final thing, though, that let me say, since I guess I've gone on a fair amount, is that it might be with these exponentially peaked measures, what these indicate is this waiting, as you said, for exponentially long times, giga years, I mean, enormous times. This is just not relevant. It's too long, and there's no reason to even think about these things. What we should think of ourselves as being in the initial transient after some Big Bang, and that we're sensitive to that initial condition. And it's the initial distribution of the Big Bang that provides this measure. Maybe it's probably flat. Well, it's flatter than this, certainly. Well, that's actually not obvious, but it seems like it has a chance of being flatter. And maybe that's the right measure. And this eternal inflation measure is just not relevant for physics. Now, if things get destroyed by these negative CC crunches, that would be a good reason to do that. Okay, but maybe even if they don't, maybe there's some reason. Why don't we live in the transient?
What do you mean?
Well, if you don't have supersymmetry, if you
those are clearly just little dots on your diagram, right? They don't fill the entire.
Yeah. That's right. So you imagine. Do you want to talk about this?
Well, I'll at least say why it's a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to imagine a crunchy
bubble.
You know
what,
Gary?
I know what's happening. I'm good for it.
Okay, so here you go. You have your crunching bubble there. Now, the point is that you can now take a sort of initial slice doing something like this, and what you know is on your initial slice, you have regions here. Okay, so whatever this bubble does can't affect anything to the left of that null surface.
Right.
Okay, so you have a region here which you know is going to evolve and have at least a piece of scribe, because that's a nice asymptotic cleft. Similarly, you have a region here which you know has to crunch, because nothing can affect that. Okay, so now you have initial data which is crunching on this side, has a little piece of null infinity, but not all of it. Okay, and the big question is what happens here? Okay, so there are several possibilities. One is that the singularity could sort of end in some sense, and I claim that gives you a violation of cosmic censorship. That's a naked singularity. It could certainly continue and go all the way out to null infinity, causally or not forbidden from that happening. That would be very bad, right? That would simply cut off this whole nice region that we thought we were living in. And what you might have thought as the nicest possibility, which is that you end up with a space-time which is just the black hole, right? You might have said, okay, the singularity comes over, but by the time it hits here, you've got all of scry, and then this is just an ordinary black hole. That you can rule out. Okay, so you're not going to be safe from having black holes. So I think it's true, although I haven't told Steve the argument yet, that you're either going to violate cosmic censorship or get one of these bad crunches.
I really hate the fact. I mean, if this bubble is supersymmetric, I hate the fact that the sort of supersymmetric theory could be this poorly behaved. supersymmetric theories aren't supposed to be this bad.
Negative cosmological functions.
No, this is zero CC.
Yeah.
This is like a bad sort of set of perturbations that affect nice zero CC.
So what are the theorems in that regard? We don't really know about stability.
Well, there is a theorem in a modified, not in this situation, but in a situation of gravity with scalar fields where, again, you get sort of singularities here and a piece of null infinity here. If your symmetries are different, okay, if you have spherical symmetry and not some hyperbolic symmetry, which is relevant here, then there is a theorem that the singularity cannot end, so you don't violate cosmic censorship. Okay, and in that case, you form a black hole, most likely, because you can form black holes if you're spherical. But
that's just these results that
that's
you and I had learned about.
Yeah, the thermos and stuff. Yeah. So you are safe in that case. But in this case, well, I don't know. The methods may show that the singularity can't end here, in which case you'd be forced to believe it goes all the way out. Or, the arguments don't apply, and you can violate cosmic censorship in this case.
So would this render that your type 2 measure held a bond?
If this happened, basically, then most of the time, you'd be eaten up. I mean, the future time-like observer would see nothing. There wouldn't be a future time-like observer. I don't even know how you talk about it.
You could just count things that have one.
You could count things that have one, but almost nothing would have one. These things are hit with probability 1, something like this is going to hit them.
So that's a prediction. You get a solid prediction here.
Yeah.
You just don't want to live with that prediction.
I think I was going to ask the questions, but that has to be the end of the sentence.